You had me frightened there. You said that they couldn't get anyone to introduce me. And that's been habitually the normal procedure. They sometimes have to flip and the odd man to see who's going to have to introduce me. I do want to thank the committee for inviting us over here. I don't think that, God, it's just a new breath. You don't realize. I don't think that we've been so warmly received in so long. This has always been a tremendous meeting to me, for me, and I have been to it on numerous occasions, and I've had the privilege of speaking a couple of times. I spoke about 13 years ago when the meeting was held out at Tulsa University, and I wish tonight I knew as much as I did then about AA. But I have so many good friends here that I've known so long, and the way you've lead your lives has been a constant source of inspiration for me. You've been very supportive of me, and I know that you have been supportive of each other. This has always been highly visible in the Tulsa area. I noticed tonight the moon's full. Does that really bother you all? It bothers me. I don't think I was supposed to get over here. Me and Mary Ruth had been eagerly anticipating the day, Friday, to arrive, and so I took the day off, and I said, well, we'll have all day to get ready and get over. And so we got up early and industriously applied ourselves about our small chores, and we finally got away about 1 o'clock. We was intending to leave at 9. We get to the midway point, and Mary Ruth says, do you want to stop and get a cup of hot tea? And I says, I sure do. When I got in there to pay, I had left my billfold and some other things at home. We had to turn around and go back to Oklahoma City and pay that damn toll twice. And I'd had my suit all cleaned and pressed to try to look presentable. I was a certain illusion I always try to create. And I had packed some mouthwash in my shaving kit. And how it got on my coat, I don't know. I'm going to tell you that I've consumed a hell of a lot of that vino. And it looks like I've been carrying a bottle here in my pocket. This is a good group here tonight. You know about this dreaded disease of alcohol, and this is the reason that we're all here, is because of alcoholism. I think, I know in the main it's the reason we're here to talk about alcoholism and possibly about the recovery program. You know, we've always had this disease. It's been around since the beginning of time. Archaeologists who dig now finds that thousands and thousands of years ago that man had always been able to brew up something or other. There seems to be something about life that in the reality it's an intolerable situation. And so they've always looked for a chemical solution. we know historically from the Bible, and we've always had alcoholics. And my first notice of the alcoholics appearing is in the book of Genesis. talked about that couple there. I don't know where's the pear on the ground or the apple in the tree that caused the problem, but the alcohol acted alcoholically. And I think that apple was symbolic. I think that they had brewed up something or other. Because right off they started acting amorously towards each other, you know. And you know, alcoholics don't take any blame, you know. And I said, drunk, says, how come you set that bed on fire? He says, didn't set it on fire, it's on fire and it got in me. So they were confronted about their behavior. And he says, it wasn't my fault. She made me do it. She was confronted, and she said, it wasn't her fault. It made it do it. And so, now ain't them rubbish? What do you think? That's my interpretation. We're looking along, and Christopher Columbus was an alcoholic. History don't record this. But if you study his activity, you know it. He took off and he didn't know where he was going. And he got there and he didn't know where he was. He went back home and didn't know where he'd been. And to cap it off, he got a woman to finance. We've always had this disease, and I want to talk about it just a little few minutes, and then I'm going to start talking about myself, which is the reason I come over here. You know, people like me has had to die in weed patches and jail houses and nut houses since the beginning of time until this century. There's been a lot of changes made in this century. A lot of technological advances made in this century. It is during our time that man went to the moon. A lot of changes medically. During my time, at one time we had five tubercular hospitals in the state of Oklahoma. Those hospitals have always all been converted to domiciliary nursing facilities for veterans because TB is under control. It was during our time that polio was a scourge of this country. The dread of the iron lung. It's under control. Just by means of immunization, it's no longer a threat. And we could go on and on and on and talk about the things that's happened in improvement of life for mankind that has been made. But I think historians who look back and assess this century will have to say the greatest benefit made was in mankind. It was during the 20th century that there became a solution to alcoholism, because we know it is the most dreaded disease of all. And I'm happy to be living. Was it 44 years ago that the solution was first recorded? 40 years ago it was reduced to writing in this book that we call Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'm real glad that here on September the 7th of 1979, this book is still intact. The disease is the same, and in our enlightened year, the solution is the same. As far as I know, there has been no basic changes changes made to it at all since it was published, other than the addition of some stories. There's one notable change. If you read in the foreword there, it says something about when there's some kind of set up the preamble of this thing. If you read there, it says that a requirement for membership is to have an honest desire to stop drinking. And I think that just went through the first publication, and they took that word honest out of there, because they found nobody had an honest desire to stop drinking. My name's Jack Wayne. I'm an alcoholic. And by God's grace, and because this program works one day at a time in my life, I haven't had a drink of anything containing alcohol since April 29th, 1964, the day I got here. And for this, I'm real grateful. I come from a large family. There's either 12 or 13 of us. I don't remember exactly. I do know that three of us become alcoholic. One got killed in a drunken brawl. One got cured by a religious conversion. And he actually made the changes. I can see his face now, how soft and so you can. I have seen direct evidence in my own family that you can get sober outside of AA. I couldn't. But I tell people everywhere I go, and I have challenges audience after audience. Without a spiritual program, there is no recovery from alcoholism, and I've yet to see it. I had my first drink about the age of 13, and I was hooked from the start. I don't know where I was able to articulate it at the time, but as I reflected back, I thought if God made anything better than this, he kept it for himself. And I was addicted right off. And seemed to me like the alcohol then must be better than it is today. It just seems. And I start drinking jar whiskey. And I see a few back here that start drinking jar whiskey. And it seemed to be the answer to me. And so I became a teenage alcoholic. You know, we talk now a great deal about, and we do have this large exodus of teenagers coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, but we've always had teenage alcoholics. Some of these teenagers now think it started with them, this drinking, you know. They think some other things started with them, too. But we've always had teenagers, and it seemed to me like that old whiskey back there, which was made to drink, and you could take a big shot of that and a little branch water, and it didn't seem to have the paralyzing effect that some of this modern-day drink has. You know, they're making this wine now. Hell, it's never seen a grape. I'm making it chemically. I see them winos drink it and two or three big shots, you know, and they're just paralyzed. And then we notice that the younger people who are coming in now also use a number of other little pharmaceutical goodies. We call them neat booze. And by some way, I'm making the chemistry set out of their stomach. They don't seem to have that period of drinking that some of us were able to enjoy. But It doesn't make any difference, I guess. It's all the same. And you get here where you can get here, but I was able to drink for a considerable number of years, and I never did develop a very high IQ, but I did develop a hell of a tolerance for alcohol. And I could drink. I was kind of always the leader of my peer group. And sometimes they didn't seem too interested, and so I'd have to encourage them. Drinking was, for the younger people, drinking was relatively inexpensive. At the time that we didn't have much money, you get a half a gallon of alcohol for a dollar where I come from, and so four of you would chip in quarter apiece. And so our rewarded time, we were to save our money, and we'd maybe have 35 or 40 cents for us and a date, you know. And so I was 25 cents in on the whiskey and a nickel for a chaser, knee-high lemon, and maybe a nickel for chewing gum. And we were off and running. So I'm still persuaded that I had a hell of a lot of fun with alcohol for a long time. And because by its very nature, it has the chemical ability to change me, to alter me, my ideas and my attitudes. And if it don't make me feel better, at least makes me feel different. And so I always, I was just an alcoholic from the word go. Now, my motivation for consuming alcohol, I think, changed through the years because initially I drank to get high on, or because of peer pressure, but more than that, more so all. Always drinking with the expectation of a rewarding experience. And initially, this was a high. As we know, the disease progresses and the motivation changes. Not clear-cut, but predominantly changes, and it goes from relief drinking to maintenance drinking. And I was able to drink long enough until, when I come in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was in the terminal stage of alcoholism where my motivation was oblivion. Stop the world and let me off. I spent quite a number of years in the military. And you know, the large percent of you had that privilege too, and the military was tailor-made for people like me. You know, you don't have to make decisions, and so you're not frustrated about that. They even tell you how, what color clothes to wear. So I fitted right in. I didn't know at the time, but my whole purpose for being that was in line with my alcoholic thinking. And I become, my disease progressed all during the service. I was going to tell you, I got kicked out of college for drinking alcohol. I was drinking in a football uniform. And we had a narrow-minded coach in those days. It didn't seem the attitude wasn't as permissive as they are now. But, well, he didn't kick me out of college. He just took my uniform away from me. And when my uniform left me, so did my groceries and my room. And then the dean finished it up. And he said, "We have no place for people like you here." And, of course, that wasn't the first time any hostility showed in my life, but it became highly evident. And so I, at that moment, I, as I look back, I began to vacillate a great deal between resentments and self-pity. these disappointments come up in my life, I'll get angry in hell, and then I'll start feeling sorry for myself. So I continued to drink during the military, and I was in for 17 and a half years on my way to be a brigadier general, at least my retirement age, because I always thought I was had a military mind. And you know, at Winston Churchill nearly killed me. My wife didn't quite understand me or my drinking either. And she would, on occasions, caution me that perhaps I might be drinking a little too much. And I said, you really don't understand military men. I said, a certain amount of this is necessary for Winston and me. I said, don't you see right here, he drinks a fifth a day. He drinks a fifth a day, I drink. I found later that was comparing apples to oranges, but it was justification to me at that time because I was under the delusion that I could drink alcohol and it would clear my head. I honestly believe that alcohol cleared my head. And we know now that alcohol, the first part of the brain that affects us is the cortex, and the cortex is where judgment is located. And so right off, you're impaired. But I actually believe alcohol would clear my head. But anyway, there's kind of a mutable law of nature and about this thing. If you live long enough and if you drink it often enough, you know, it'll finally bring you knees. I don't give a damn how strong you are, and I was pretty strong. I don't know if you ever heard my description of an alcoholic. They say that we've got the body of a rhinoceros. And I think this is literally true because we go to work when other people are going to the hospital. Because we got to go to work to make some money and get some drink, you know. And most of us come out in pretty good shape after long years of dissipation. So they say we've got the body of a rhinoceros and we've got the memory of an elephant. And this is true. There ain't one of you in here that ain't got something written down somewhere, maybe mentally memoranda, that you're going to get even with something at the first chance you get. And that may have happened 20 years ago, but you still got her in there. You remember when they tried to do you in. And then they said, we've got the head of a jackass. And this seems to be literally true. Because some of us have to take a lot of really beating and painful anguish before we are ready to surrender to our disease. And so I went all through the whole thing. I remember there's no boy Tulsa conference. I think Jack remembers him and Russell and some of these and Jess remembers. His name is Jack Odom. And I heard it on one of the first tapes that I ever heard of an Alcoholics Anonymous talk. And I'm reminded of it periodically, and it come to my mind tonight. And this is the only thing I remember about his tape. And I think he says, if you're new or nearly new, don't worry about your daydreams not coming true. Just thank God them nightmares are gone. Well, there was some people who got a meddling in my business, as sometimes they're prone to do, fooling around with something that is none of their concern. And so they finally got their heads together and was looking for me. And they didn't know where to put me. They had placed me on a on a rock. They had me out on the damned islands out there for about 16 months. They thought if they would keep me out there, I would get sober. And when I went out there, there was, I hope none of those people are in here. There's a good deal of trepidation, I mentioned, because there was about 350 airmen and about 20 officers and about 50 civilians out there on this little island. And they were privileged to have their drinks, and of course, most of them, I guess, drink normally, and was out there for 30 days, and so it was. But when I come out, I brought a little piece of paper with me that the general had wrote, and he says, there'll be no more intoxicants on the island. So I was about as popular as a good case of gonorrhea at the beginning. And they all dried up, and I continued to drink. And there's where I found that wine, because I could function on wine. Have we got any winos in here? I see the hands of the winos. We got a bunch of damn lars here. How many winettes? This is the worst I've ever... I like to talk when we got some winos, because I can talk to them, because we got a kind of a different language of our own, you know. And I always remember what Wino Joe says, you know, he says, winos don't cough much. We got more than two here. We got more than two here. So I start on that wine because I could function on it. And I drink a lot of it. But they got together and they decided they would send me to a hospital for evaluation. Now you talk about the resentments and the self-pity. Now these really begin to stir up. Because here I was, a dedicated military man. And I thought nearly an A1, number one parent and husband. Oh, I knew that my behavior was bizarre on occasion, but hell, everybody's was. But here my wife gets in with these military people, and I don't know, she takes off and takes off with my kid. And these military people put me on an airplane and they said, we're going to take you to a hospital. Now, can you imagine how I felt after all I'd done for them? Both of them? Who wouldn't be angry? Well, they took me down there and I had some suspicions that I hadn't been able to really acknowledge to myself. I kind of get on the verge of it, and it's a little painful, and I'd suppress them. But I think I had some inklings and suspicions, maybe some paranoia, but it was well-founded of what they was going to do to me. And so, while I was in this hospital, again, the meddlers come around. And they got a hold of a member of AA, and this is down there, AA was just starting in the military service. There's a master sergeant down there, had found the program. And so he had gained some respect on this Air Force base. So he had got a captain involved, and the captain had got sober. So they sicked the captain on me. And I had heard a little about Alcoholics Anonymous before I went down there. Because my nosy wife had written Ann Landers about me. And she referred her to AA. And so Meredith had got a hold of some of these pamphlets and had laid them around. We call that silent nagging. And I don't remember why I give her much concern or not. And why should it? Because it didn't apply to me. But while I was in there, this captain come a-traipsing in, and he had the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous under his arm. Somebody had turned me in. And he says, I understand that you're having trouble with your drinking. I said, not me. I'm having trouble getting it. It's the only trouble I'm having. And right there, you know, he described the difference between a drinking problem and a problem drinker. Problem drinker means you're having problems with drinking. A drinking problem means you're out of whiskey. And that was my dilemma. I didn't have none. And the insidiousness of our disease and the delusions that is inherent and attendant to our disease prevents us from seeing it. And he said, you got a problem? I said, you damn right I've got a problem. Up to here. I've got them. You name them, I've got them. Car, finance, wife, girlfriends, anything, I've got them. And I said, you drink too, by God, if you had as many as I've got. Because alcohol wasn't my problem, it was my solution. And I didn't know that I had this committed relationship with this drug so strong that I could not control it. I didn't know that I couldn't separate, because I told him, you know what I told him? I coined the one. I said, I'm quitting time I want to. And if it's bothering me, I told him another. Y'all can leave me alone, because I ain't bothering nobody but myself if I am. And so he told me about this big book, and he told me about himself. And he conned me into buying that book. I thought he made a gesture, and I thought he was going to give it to me, and I said, thank you, and he said, 4.5, I think. But I read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I read the stories, and some way I was able to muster enough self-honesty that I said, if that's an alcoholic, I'm one. But I was real careful who I disclosed this to. I was willing to admit him. So he come back home, he said, you think you're alcoholic? I says, a little. I think maybe I'm a little. But he introduced me to the program, and he worked with me while I was in the hospital. But I guess he would call it unsuccess. And I got a letter from this man a number of years later. And he says, and he said in the letter to me, he says, I recall you were one of my first pigeons. And he says, I also recall your last statement that you made to me before boarding the train, that you had all of the program, you understood all of the program except the stop drinking part. you hadn't been able to understand it. And you know it for a number of years. That was too profound, too deep for me. But I recognized it in a number of other people that I've worked with through the years. And it's just this. If you go to quit drinking, you got to stop drinking. Damn, I like to never figure that one out. But anyway, he was one of the keys in my life. And so they retired me. Should have shot me. Up here before the PE board drunk. And they said, we're going to give you 50% and retire you. And my arrogancy, and I would suppose a great deal of bluff, because they didn't give me a great deal of courage. Some people called it lack of discretion, but I call it courage, because I could take action. And I told them, I said, if I'm not more 50%, give me my suit, I'm going back to work. They said, we'll give you that, give it all to you. Just get out of here. Then you can get out, and so I took it and left. And I wasn't seeking a solution for my drinking either. I had conned Mary Ruth back about this time. And I told her, well, I recognize that I did overdrink at times, and from now on, her expectations of me would be social drinking. I would normally have a drink too on Christmas, and she could expect that, but she certainly, now that I was out of the military, I would be able to handle it. So I got her and the kid back, and I continued to drink, daily drinking, first thing in the morning to the last thing. And I was out in the country where I didn't have any supervisors, and I worked better this way. I always hated somebody breathing down my neck. You know, the orders and instructions I wanted was what again, Churchill told Montgomery, you know, take North Africa. My God, don't mess the details for me. Just give me kind of a clue and I will get her done. But they start breathing out my neck, hell, I'll cut out. And somebody wanted me to tell this. Some couple people asked me, and so I'm going to tell them a cat story. By this time, a number of our resources were depleted. And was living in an old house with no insulation. The shingling was questionable, and no plumbing. And on the front porch, I had some boards just laid across the tube of porch, across the runners there, you know. I was always going to put a porch on them. I never did get to. So you had to be very careful on the approach, but the board was kind of solid. And there was no plumbing, as I say. My wife had to carry water in a gallon jar. And one of the reasons I tell you is to show how people like me's values can become so distorted. The things that seem important, how we can lay them aside. But I kept telling me that story. Tomorrow it'll be different. Tomorrow it'll be different. Day after day, week after week. I'll quit tomorrow. And so my wife and daughter was living out in the country out there in these blackjacks, and there wasn't too much entertainment going on, and damn little companionship. And so they developed a hobby, and they started gathering up cats. And they began to bring a bunch of these old boy cats in with these old girl cats. And they did multiply. And them damn things is everywhere, and I'd always hated them and do today. I don't like cats. Every time I step out the door, one of them's under your feet, you know.
Meow, meow.
But this house didn't have any insulation. And it kind of fits in with this energy shortage, because we was experiencing it then. As soon as that cold weather blew in, and this old house was approximate to a hay barn. If you got a hay barn, you got rats, you know, and mice. And so these cats begin to pay off of it, because early in the fall, we allowed two or three to stay in the house, and they begin to sleep on the bed. And we didn't have too much covers because I stole about 3 GI blankets when I left the service. So did you. You brought them on board. And what I'm talking about wasn't the value of them, other than cinnamon. Later, they had an extra thing. That's just an extra dividend, you know. And so we wasn't too well loaded with covers. And as the winter began to approach and began to get cold in this old house, we began to let more cats in. And they all began to sleep on the bed. And we had to say, and if you get cold, just pull up another cat. I didn't worry about that damn water too much because I wasn't bathing too often anyway. I figured if I was going to take a bath, I'd go to the river. But it's always going to be different. Now, here I was, and I'm going to give you this picture. I was 37 years old. I weighed 195 pounds. I got one other characteristic. I was virile as hell. And damn near a genius. And here I had taken my family. I can go down now. I can go down now and see that old face and cry. I can just cry. To think that anybody would take their family and subject them to this kind of a situation. But I'll tell you what it did. In that, I still had a big red Buick. Four-holer. And Mary Ruth had bought me a big hat in San Antone. 4X. God damn, I was proud of that cowboy hat. And I had on them tight jeans. You know the way these girls wearing them now? And I'd put them heels on, you know, and I'd tighten up them jeans and get in that big red car and I'd go to town. And I'd go in some of those high-class places I frequented, big shotting, talking about the range. And I'd whip off that 4X brand, you know, I never had a hat that good or since. Calling their attention to how well I was doing. And I made nice places, too. The places I attended to. Some of them had a 25-cent cover charge to keep the riffraff out. And real high places. Well, I continued to drink and keep going downhill and downhill. I'm going to hear, hell, we may not even get into AA here. You know, some people say, I'm not going to tell a drunk log. That's all I've got. And so I went on what I hope was my last drunk. And I come home and I'm going to tell you what I did before I went on. Because I drink around the all time. I never was free of alcohol. But then I would double up, you know, and I'd go eat and... And I come in one day, reason I'll tell you this, people has asked me, most of them are civilians, how long did your wife stay with you when you was drinking? I said, 22 years. They'd say, why did she stay with you that long? Of course, now I say, quitters don't make it to Al-Anon. She wanted to go to Al-Anon. She had to stay there. And that's true, you know, quitters don't make it down with them. I don't know whether that's very bad or not, but by God, they stay with us. But I'm gonna tell you all the truth, the way she stayed with me. She told me to leave many times, and I've left many times. We packed a great deal for each other. But I told her, I wanted to do something, you know, that day. but still wasn't bathing. And I didn't know that wine smelled like that. And I got my very presents to get them ready. Just walk in, you know. And trigger it. But for some reason, I got a certain denial. And I was going to get away anyway. And so I just told her that day as I started packing. Because there's certain things I always took with me. I had a .45 with no clip and a couple of shirts and anything I could get to drink always went in the suitcase. And one more key item. Now, this is where I held her. I don't know where you are. Some of you men might have, too. I had my insurance program. And I told her that day, I said, "Sister, you've really ripped your drawers this time." I said, "If you expect to be the beneficiary of my estate." And I figure that's why you're hanging around, because you don't think I'm going to make it much longer, and I'm voting with her. There's certain moral and legal rights that men have to enjoy, and I'm being denied. And I said, "Your name comes off of that." You see, this was a $3,000 policy. And she's willing to share it. "What the hell would you have done?" She didn't treat you like that. But anyway, I took off and I went on the last drink. So I called her up about 3 days later and I says, "I'm coming home. I'm going to join the leper farm." That's what I called y'all. I knew you was damn well losers because you couldn't even drink. I knew that right off the bat. I didn't know too much about you as a fellowship. And so she said, "Come on home." And so I come home and she said I brought a bottle of vodka home with her. With me and told her to pour it out. I don't ever remember that. She didn't tell me that till after I was about 3 months dry that I told her, and she did. I remember many times I told her she damn sure better not pour it out. But she says, I said I was through. And I called Abe. And there's an old man come out to see me. And he told me, I think, one of the greatest things that I ever heard in my life. And somebody asked me a while ago as I come in and says, "You come up to bring us a message, didn't it?" And I have, and I'm going to give you that message because that man gave it to me. And it didn't mean anything to me at that time because I wasn't listening too closely to him. I was trying to impress him up with my potential. I was trying to tell him that I was just down on my luck and just needed a little help. But he told me, I think, the greatest thing that an alcoholic ever hears. He said, "You won't ever have to take another drink if you don't want to." Now, isn't that something? The difference between life and death for us all. And that's the message. You don't ever have to take another drink if you don't want to, because there is a solution here. He told me in the course of things what had happened to him. And I think he read the promises to me, which have no meaning for me at the time. And my faith in him began to wane a little. Because I was in the draws and I didn't have the shakes, I had the jerks. Ever damned arms flying up here, all of the involuntary muscle spasms, you know, and you think you're choking. And I don't know where he thought I was acting or not. And I had heard about those 12 steppers, and I thought he was neglecting me. And I kept wondering when he's going to ask me, "Would you like to have a little drink of this to help you over?" But he didn't ask me. So finally I asked him. And so he gave me a prescription, and I passed this RX on that he handed to me. He said, "We find walking helps." And that's what left me. And he says, "You can go 24 hours without drinking." And I said, "There ain't no way unless you lock me up, and don't do that." He says, "Can you go 10 hours without drinking?" I said, "No." And he said, "Can you go an hour without a drink?" And I said, "No, I can't go an hour without a drink. I'm going to have something pretty soon." And because I knew where there's two little old bottles, the stubby bottles of, I think it's Jack's, or Lonely Star. Some of the high-class beer. And I was wanting him to get the hell out of there because I just couldn't put her off any longer. You know, I'm amazed at people who drink and have to drink out of thin-stemmed glasses, you know. I'm really amazed at them. I drank horse urine if it tests 3-2. There was no putting it off for me. I had to have some. I know what it is to want to drink, because during that day, I would have given both of my arms for one of those bottles of beer. And I didn't want to ask, didn't want to pull out those beers before him, because first I thought that I had some kind of obligation for him to come out and see me, and then I began to say, and he may not be telling me the truth. If I bring those two beers out, he may want one. And I knew that one wasn't going to do a hell of a lot of good. And so he says, "Can you go 5 minutes?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll try that." And so he did leave. And here's where the non-alcoholic comes into play. There was no way in this world do I believe that I could have got sober without Mary Ruth. Because she was there, and so I'd go 5 minutes, and I'd say, "Jack, go another five, and I'll buy you a double. You can have both them damn beers you want." And she was there with her love and attention. And I think there was a certain amount of coercion attached to this, as I recall. It wasn't all tender and affection. I think she said, "You better try five more if you're going to stay out here." But anyway, I got through. 9 days later, I made my first AA meeting. She started getting ready to go to the first AA meeting. I said, "Where the hell are you going?" She said, "I'm going to you." I said, "You are not." I thought she's going down there to pay penance for me. And I said, "I got us into this, and I'll get us out. You don't need to go down there with those people. Because half of them can't read or write anyway." I said, "They're not like me." And so finally, she persuaded me that she ought to go, and I took her with me. And all the time we was going in, I was trying to keep from shocking her, and I was telling her some differences to expect when she got in with that crowd down there. They didn't prepare correctly, because I got there and they weren't like me. God, they all had, looked like every one of them had a Buick or Cadillac when we drove up. I got there and you'll see no threads on those people. Not like me. I had on 3 pairs of pants, you can still see my ass. And they were all happy. God, we hadn't laughed in years. We hadn't had anything to laugh about. God, that was a bunch of people. As soon as I saw them, I wanted to be like them. I have never been ashamed a moment in my life of being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I knew right off they was doing infinitely better than I was. I knew what they was doing, but I wanted to be part of it. Except one old codger. And as I walked out that night, they had me feeling pretty good because they were shaking my hands. And God, nobody would shake my hand. That Christmas, me and Mary Ruth got one Christmas card. And I forgot whether it was from an indebtor or a politician. We was all out in left field. We know about loneliness. Nobody cared, not really. I had alienated them all from us. But these people shook hands, and God, I thought this is great. But this one will call you as I walked out the door, and I heard him say, yeah, you probably brain damaged, as I look back now. He said, I think that one's waited too long. I'm going to tell you a story, and then I'm going to tell you, I've got two stories, and then I'll wind this up. You know, the government, this is the thing that amazes me, and God knows they try. And they make a lot of advancement, but you know what they're trying to do, and they're allocating great large blocks of grants to study alcoholism. Have you, what they're about to do? Well, they got two or three proposals. One is they want to know what made us alcoholics. And they're shooting brown rats and white rats and everything. Did y'all ever see an alcoholic who didn't drink alcohol? Who's the reason we're alcoholics? If you show me an alcoholic that never drank alcohol, I won't see it. We drank too damn much, too often, too long. Every one of us. Whatever amount it was for us, it was too much for us. But the real tricker, they want to make us normal drinkers. And I'll say there's not a one of you in here, if you actually think about it, want to go back to be a normal drinker. I was privileged to be at a big wedding over here in Oklahoma City at the Country Club. And I set myself kind of proximate to the bar. I always like to sit close to the bar, even if I don't drink. I mean, the people up there are my types. And I don't care what they don't disgust me what they drink, it's how they drink it. I got to watch this son of a bitch, and he'd been there about an hour with that same glass in his hand. And he just kept talking and had this thing, and I kept thought, well, I believe I'll go over the bottle and come over and sweeten it up for him. And he just made me sick. And after about an hour, he started towards the horse's head there with it. I said, good, he's going to get him another. Went over there, and he whispered something to the bartender. And I thought he was going to say, give me a double this time. He says, have you got another ice cube? Now, you mean something you want to drink like that? Here's the way they do. They'll say, come over to the house, I've got a fifth. And you go over to the house, and as soon as you get in, they start talking about football or some damn thing that has nothing related to drinking, and they forgot why we come. And so finally you have to mention it to them. I know all about this, let's have a drink, and then we'll talk about it. And they go get this jug, and they have got a new fifth. And then they go into this terrible problem of getting the top off. They go back in the kitchen, they fiddle around getting gadgets. Now, just make that little Sidlord seal, you know. And it takes them seemingly 30 minutes to get. And here they come out with their glasses. They've always got glasses to drink out of. And I put her down there, and you watch them. They never let that cap out of their hand. When they took that cap off that whiskey, they kept it. And they pour you a drink, and they pour you a drink. And they start for the closet. And they reach back, and they says, come in Christmas, and we'll have another. This is February. Now, who in the hell wants to drink like that? Ain't a one of you. If I drink, I want to drink with you. I hope I never take another drink, and I hope you don't either. But if I want to drink, I want to drink with you. Because when we go in the house, the first thing you do is get it. And you know how to get it off there, and we're with it. And the first drink, we don't use no glass. And later, if we use glass, it's a jelly glass. And you throw the damn top away, and I sit on the chair, because I know we're going to be here for a while. The singular most important thing that's happened to be to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the fellowship is beautiful. I've been privileged to love and love so many people in this program. A large part of them are here. But the greatest thing that happened to me, and I think that happens to all of us, we begin to follow the tenets, the basic tenets, that probably no human power could relieve us of our alcoholism. But God could and would if he was sought. Coming to believe in that power is the thing that has made the difference in my life. It's the thing that not only relieved me from alcoholism, but the thing that makes life to me worthwhile now. Something that I can subordinate my judgment to. God, how good it is to put it in a sack and say, this is impossible, you take it. I'll do the possible, this is impossible, you take it. And wrapped up in this is this word admittance and acceptance. If we got somebody here that's new or nearly new to that, and this is not the altar call, and you want to save your derriere, surrender. Therein. This is a hell of an adventure. I didn't get to tell you how it is like now because it is a fairy tale. No one would believe to the things that's happened to me and my family because I have not had to take this next drink. And that was all brought about. Here I am, a crazy animal with no prognosis. Everybody says it's SOB or die drunk. And I've spoken with them. There's no way to get out. I had exhausted all avenues and possibilities of leaving alcohol alone, and I just couldn't leave her alone. And because a bunch of drunks told me to look on page 55 of the big book. That was my old football number. I wore it for about 7 years, 55. And on page 55, they told me to look. And there would be a revelation there for me. See, all the time I had been looking for God between Uranus and Saturn. I thought it was something up there. As we know now, we have been sending missiles up there. We had one up by Saturn, which took 4 years to get there. And during its travelings, it was connected with telemetering and communications equipment to the Earth by TV and so forth. And it reported constant data to the planet Earth, and not once did it say, I just saw God, or I just passed through heaven. Some of you knew or nearly knew who probably are a little dubious about God yourself. And this is probably because you haven't got a telephone call from him. Because you want tangible results, and I understand this. But if you get a telephone call from him, you got something besides alcoholism. I can tell you that right now. Be here and watch. If you want to see God, watch a now crazy alcoholic come in and get sober. And I think you'll see God. He's evident, he's everywhere. And on this page, as I had made more than a cursory examination into various religions trying to find some kind of satisfaction for the ultra too bigness of life, and I never could quite cut it. And a bunch of drunks told me, look on this page. And the last place I would have ever looked. And it says on there, the fundamental idea of God is in every man, woman, and child. And it goes on down. And it says, and at last we found the great reality, capital R, deep within inside of ourselves. The last place that God could ever look. And because I was able to do that, and because I have had your love and support all these years, we hadn't had to take a drink. I'm closing the way I like to always close, and that's a hell of a chapter, is 11 in the big book, if you haven't read it. It says our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we only know a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to me. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do for the alcoholic who still suffers. The answer will come if your house is in order. Obviously, you cannot transmit something that you haven't got. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship, in the spirit, and we shall surely meet some of you as we trudge the road to happy destiny. May God bless and keep you. You've been a swell audience, and thanks so much for having me.